Hello, and thank you for joining us for today's webinar. I'm Nancy Stone with RealCom, and we're pleased to be presenting part two of the CRE Enterprise Tech Series, which will explore investment management enterprise solutions. Our panel today will be discussing the vendor selection process, implementation, integrations, and their technology roadmaps. Before we get started, let's review a few housekeeping items. First, to submit questions, please use the Q&A box located on the control panel somewhere on your screen. If the panel isn't visible, look for the red arrow that opens and closes it. We'll try to answer your questions during the session or follow up with you after if we run short of time. For the best webinar experience, we suggest you close any other internet applications you might have running. If you have technical issues during the session, feel free to contact me at nstone@realcom.com. And lastly, this webinar is being recorded, and a link to the recording will be sent to all registrants. We'd like to thank today's gold sponsors, CohnReznick, DealPath, MRI, Navigator CRE, and Yardi. You'll be hearing from each of these companies during the session. Today's webinar will be moderated by Chuck Nisswanger. Chuck is the president of Nice Nets Consulting, a technology advisory services company specializing in commercial and corporate real estate. He provides businesses with guidance on technology strategy, selection, integration, and implementation. He is a longtime partner of RealCom and has been the chair of our Investment Management Advisory Board for many years. Chuck, welcome, and thank you for moderating today's panel.
Great. Thank you, Nancy. I appreciate it. I always enjoy getting the opportunity to moderate these webinars, so I think I'm going to try to move my slide back one real quick. But last fall, I wanted to just let everybody know I did get a chance to work with John Seaton from Real Foundations, and we put together a combined client case study session for RealCom 2020, and it allowed five different companies to tell their investment management story. And what was so interesting about that was each of them ended up selecting a different vendor at the end of this process. And we'll put a link in the show notes here in just a few minutes if you want to see the recording of that. It was done in October of last year, and I wrote a blog about it, and we'll have a link to that as well. And what was interesting to note is that when companies tell their story about this journey that they have for selecting new software or integrating new software, they start to develop these common themes. And for those in our live audience or those even watching the recording, you might be considering new software, minimizing your application portfolio, or even making existing applications work better together. And I'll have a survey for you in just a few minutes so see if we can capture why you're attending this seminar, this webinar. And based on those common themes, I put together this sort of Jeff Foxworthy style common indicators that you might need new software. So if you're describing your current investment management system and you have over 20 non-integrated solutions that include things like Excel, Access, ACT, Timberline, CTI, or even a menu-driven green screen like this, like Orpheus, you might need new software. And shout out to John Avery of Legal and General Investment Management for that example. If your business process for sending out investor reports involves large stacks of paper with multiple people in a conference room manually collating paper folders to put in the mail, you might need new software. And hat tip to Michael DiBenedetto of Northland Group Investment Group. And this is my hair on fire themes that I heard from multiple different clients. If your president is on the phone with an investor and runs into your office asking which funds they are in, what are their latest returns, and when was their last distribution, you might need new software. And kudos to Scott McGinnis of Cohen Asset Management for sharing that. And if your CEO asks a new question about the company's investment portfolio and has already accepted the fact that they're going to have to wait a week to get the answer, you might need new software. If the number of assets in your investment portfolio has grown along with the number of investors and your current system can't keep track of everything, if your third-party property managers are sending you Excel and PDF reports in all different formats and non-standard chart of accounts, you might need new software. And hat tip to Jacob Teplin of Crow Holdings for sharing that one. If your company has already tried new software and tried to do an implementation, but the project dragged on so long it was eventually scrapped, you might need new software. And if the bulk of your investors are telling you they don't want to receive paper copies of their investment report, company performance documentation, or any other report that could be delivered electronically through a portal, you might need new software. So I'm sure we're going to hear more examples of that from our panelists today. But one last point, and it came through on a lot of the different case studies. We heard that once that vendor selection process is going along, at some point, it becomes less about the technology and more about the relationship, who you can work with, who you can trust. And I think you may hear some of that echoed today. So given those examples, I'm going to run a couple of polls right now. And I just want you to think about, in this first section, what could you identify with some of those examples that I just gave, that I mentioned in my opening themes. And in this case, what was the main reason why you joined the webinar today? You've got about 15 seconds to answer that. This is your opportunity for audience participation. So let us know why you're here. Hopefully I gave you something, otherwise we'll know that it's something else. Let's see what our results are from that one. So 50% of the people said something else. So I didn't get it right when I gave you the examples. A few say their process is inefficient, and over half are big fans of some panel member. All right, that's interesting. All right, thanks. Let's go with the next question. In this one, I'm just thinking about your company's process for selecting new software or making a significant change in technology. Which of these statements best describes your company's process, if any of them? Take about 10 more seconds to collect what we can. All right, let's see the results. Steering committees, big one. Internal IT departments select their own, or internal departments select their own software. That is scary. We can talk about why. It seemed like I gave you better examples here, so that's good. That gives our panelists and our technology partners a good indication of the mix of our audience. So let me bring in our first guest speaker. This is Tyson Stronberg from Bell Partners. She's the Director of Client Relations. So Tyson, let's hear your story from Bell Partners.
Thank you so much, Chuck. I can relate to a lot of those pain points. And so hopefully you'll hear some themes throughout my presentation as well. But I'm Tyson Stronberg and Director of Client Relations at Bell Partners. And I really focus on the investor and client experience and manage our investment management platform. So look forward to sharing our journey today. And here goes. So Bell Partners, quick intro of who Bell Partners is. We are an experienced real estate investment and property management firm. We manage about $11 billion of assets, so around 63,000 units. And we have hundreds of investors. We pride ourselves on our client experience and track record, which has resulted in really 80% repeat investors from fund to fund. So one of our core values at Bell is prepare for the future today. And that was really a key driver when selecting a new investment management platform. We were in dire need of a new solution. Our investor relations team was drowning in non-value-add activities. We were answering the phone to provide contributions amounts, for example. And as Chuck mentioned, we also were kind of by the red phone when an executive was talking to an investor to provide the details of that relationship. So our objectives for a new platform were to engage investors, offer self-service options, and most importantly, provide a front-end solution to our back-end data stored in your EIN. One of the things we do at Bell Partners, and specifically in our department that we find helpful, is name our projects. So we dubbed this project Project Bamboo, and that was due to the characteristics of strength, versatility, and longevity that really met the needs for the project. And we find a project name kind of produces buy-in. When you have clear objectives, it helps get a broader team on board for your project. So speaking of a project team, this was really led by client relations and in the investor relations team, but in coordination with the IT team and a broader steering committee. Next, I'll talk about our selection process. So we used a robust RFP process, and as you'll see, this is our criteria that's shown on the screen here. But Juniper Square was a clear shining star. They really differentiated themselves from the beginning with clear and comprehensive responses to our questions, and they met both our functional needs, such as the fundraising automation, which I'll talk about in a moment, and the softer aspects such as ease of navigation, aesthetics, and those various pieces. Our implementation journey was long, but it was successful. So we started really in 2016 when we determined a new solution was needed. And then from there, it really took 6 months after we selected a vendor to implement. So a reasonable time frame, but in the beginning, we spent about 3 months after the project was launched to complete the RFP and determine timelines and things of that nature. And then once Juniper Square was selected, there was really 3 months of kind of scoping and cleaning up our data, which was a big piece that we wanted to be sure to do on the front end so that we had a great result on the back end when we launched the system. And then 3 months of testing and launching, and finally launched in 2018. And our launch included both internal marketing, so we continued with the Project Bamboo theme internally. We had a party with tacos and bamboo necklaces. And then externally, we sent a postcard, a lot of emails to investors, and ultimately it resulted in a pretty quick 60% adoption rate from investors, which improved from about 20% in our prior system. So we're proud of that. And then it has increased even more since then. And one last piece I'll talk about here. So the integration was really a key initiative of this project. So we ultimately integrated Yardi.im through an automatic overnight feed to Juniper Square, which really results in a best-in-class portal experience for our investors and our internal stakeholders. Our portal went from ThisView, which I understand this has been updated since 2016, but at the time we were in search of a more comprehensive solution, to this view. So we really felt we had moved kind of from the Stone Age to the 21st century, and the ease of use, the functionality, and the adoption really exceeded our expectations. One of the key differentiators and really standout aspects of the Juniper Square system for us was fundraising automation. So many of you may relate to this, but we were stuck in clunky prospect lists in Excel, a huge mailing initiative like Chuck's Pictures. That was us at a conference room mailing hundreds of offering materials. And then we would receive offering documents, completed subscription documents, and we would have to kind of translate illegible handwriting. Finally, our CFO would have to countersign hundreds of subscription documents. And ultimately, we were able to automate the full system. It's integrated with DocuSign, so it really created some huge efficiencies and streamlined processes. And the results here kind of speak for themselves, but it certainly reduced man hours. We were able to raise $100 million in less than 30 days. And some of that was because we could see clearly each step of the way when investors had started a subscription, completed a subscription, and it helped for the fundraising team as well, because they could log on to Juniper Square and see in real time the status of the fundraise. So that was something that was incredibly helpful and beneficial from the system. And then on the back end, it materially improved accuracy and completeness of our investor records. Rather than having to translate data from their subscriptions, the system really creates accounts and does that process for you. So one thing I will say here is it took some time to update internal habits, and some of our internal stakeholders still expected kind of investor relations to send them their reports, but we really have to drive them to Juniper Square. And then once they were on the system and saw the real-time results, they pretty quickly adopted that process. So next, really ongoing development, and it is ongoing. That is the truth. We've met our objectives in terms of implementing the system, but we continue to enhance the functionality and improve. One thing that we did recently is integrate and break out our cash flows, which has allowed us to use the waterfall and return calculations in Juniper Square rather than outside in Excel. So we feel like we are on our way, but there certainly is more to go. And finally, just we're continuing to build out that reporting. Some of it is within our asset dashboards, and we have really been adopting the functionalities as quickly as Juniper Square has been developing. So they've been a great partner, and I can't say enough about the importance of having a technology partner that you work well with and is responsive. And it's ultimately resulted in a really great experience for our investors and for our internal stakeholders.
That's good. The relationship then was a real key piece for you.
Absolutely. From the very beginning, they were great and very responsive, and we enjoyed working with them, which is important as well.
I got to ask you this question real quick, and then we'll move on. I have a quote from you from your last presentation in October, and you mentioned a nasty mail merge process and chunky Excel. Tell me, what is chunky Excel? How do you define it?
Long, lots of data, lots of rows. It wouldn't filter because it was so long. Different people were trying to use it, but it wasn't collaborative. And so it was just not, it was inefficient, and it was not helpful.
All right. Good. Thanks, Tyson. I just love that term. Not very colorful. I appreciate it. So we're going to bring in our next presenter. This is Chris Jeline. He's the manager of private markets and global technology at Invesco, and probably less about an investor selection process as it is about evolving the system into something more. All right, Chris, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Yep. Thank you very much. Can you hear me, Chuck? Great. So thank you, everyone. I just want to briefly introduce myself and talk about Invesco, who we are. So my name is Christopher Jeline, for those of you who don't know me, and I manage all of our investor applications and technology, supporting the private markets business within Invesco. So, you know, all real assets, real estate, and some private equity. Today, I'm going to talk a little bit, actually, I'm going to talk only about our real estate products. And our footprint is just over 83 billion assets under management. It covers three continents, North America, Europe, and Asia. Mostly direct investments, but some listed assets, products that we support and manage. Globally, about 588 employees supporting the business directly, 21 offices, 16 countries. So we're spread out quite a bit. And you know, that sets the stage, I think, just in context with the broad scope of regions are the products and you know, our multiple investor types, I should say. So as Chuck mentioned, I'm not going to talk about a specific project or vendor selection process. I'm going to go a little bit higher and talk about our overarching approach that Invesco takes towards managing the global enterprise footprint and mitigating the risk associated with all these vendors and software providers globally, and how they're supporting localized regions, but hopefully taking advantage of a global relationship. So just to set the stage on my next slide, a couple slides, I'm going to talk you really briefly through, hopefully, North America and Europe. I'm going to skip Asia for the sake of time. I'll keep it high level. And I'm also just talking about, you know, managing this life cycle of an asset right now. What are we doing through the acquisition process and reporting? So in North America, a lot of third-party software and a lot of managed services. Yardi is our core financials for performance and consolidation. And we push Yardi down to our service providers where we can. That means all of our property managers, and that they're in our system for a source of truth. We don't do that for our residential properties. We use RealPage to collect our operational data and put it into RealPage BI, but we do collect the financials, and that goes in the Yardi. We're leveraging Argus Enterprise for cash flows, a product called Mango REIX for valuations, warehouse, and communications with brokers, and then a lot of other cast of characters out there, BTS, Cardin, Chatham. But we also have, on top of the software, we have a lot of managed services. multiple property managers, over 70 across our 500 assets in North America. Alta Services, again, for valuations, the RealPage collection of data for Resi, and then Real Foundations, which has completed a great project with them collecting over 100 assets or JV properties that we didn't have enough equity or couldn't force them into our platform. Moving on briefly, that's a touchy button. Moving on to Europe, third-party software again, Yardi for core financials, but we use a product called LucaNet for consolidations. Argus Enterprise, we're in the midst of a deployment of Argus Voyanta, which is a very interesting product for us. We can talk a little bit about why we chose that over pushing everyone into Yardi. And then on the managed service side, again, massive number of property managers, over 60. A lot of entity level accounting where we've outsourced some of our fund, not quite fund consolidation, but a lot of that corporate accounting. And then Alta Services doing data collection for us, similar to what we're doing with Real Foundations in North America. So just to keep it clear, this is just the asset. This is not the investor relations side. This is not so much on the acquisition side, but there's a lot going on. And so what I want to talk about really is, how do we manage all of this and how do we mitigate it? So make no mistake, it looks like two companies there based on the platform and the processes. And it would look like three, possibly four, if I showed you all of our regions. But like I said, make no mistake, Invesco operates strategically as a single company. We offer cross strategy and cross regional products. And at the investor level, it's very, they don't see the difference at the bottom, but locally there can be very different operational processes. Anyone at a scale of Invesco or anyone operating multiple localities are going to know that this means you can't always do things the same way. So multiple vendors, multiple levels, like I mentioned, property managers and accountants, a lot of different managed services, whether it's energy reporting, data collection, valuation services, transfer companies. The first thing you want to say is, why don't we consolidate this? Why are we using so many things? So I just want to talk a little bit about why. Of course, it would be nice to have just five property managers in North America instead of, say, 70. But that's just not feasible for us where we're not the operator. We're the owner on behalf of our investors. And due to the nature of a lot of our JV deals or our acquisition model, it's just not possible. A lot of those service providers, at least property managers, they're maybe in a niche market or they're part of the acquisition deal. Where we can, and there is an initiative to consolidate where we can, we work with internal procurement and Invesco and our vendor management teams to really consolidate and leverage relationships with those preferred vendors, hopefully to mutual benefit. And there's a lot of details behind, I won't get into it, but there's a lot of analysis behind which of those preferred vendors we really want to be with. And going back to where consolidation becomes tough for us, it's, like I said, the JV or niche deals, we have to go with specific property managers. Where localization impacts us, especially in EMEA and Asia, where some software hasn't quite caught on yet, or hasn't been adopted, most likely by brokers or service providers. Also, in some countries, we have asset managers who've never heard of Yardi, or they've never heard of MRI, or they've never heard of BTS. And, getting them on board, it's a certain level of trust that, we have to deal with. Also, a lot of unique leasing terms and clauses in our leases, like especially in Germany and Sweden and Finland, that really require us, if we want to push a single platform out in Europe, like we have in North America, it requires us to invest more than we're probably comfortable in doing in the product itself and in support of the products itself. So, we have very complex operations also. I'll give you an example in Europe, in Poland, where we have to charge in zlotys, we collect in euros, and then we consolidate in pounds. So there's a lot of currency issues going on, a lot of processes going on. And then lastly, why we have challenges with consolidation of vendors is, a lot of local domain expertise and staffing is not just cross-pollinated across all of, say, Europe or all of Asia. some companies, like I don't want to pick on anyone, but you know, some property managers may not be as strong the further east you go in Europe as they are perhaps in France or in the UK. So these market constraints, not all service providers are equal across every locality. And then lastly, you know, as we talk about consolidation, you know, maybe moving past consolidation of providers, but technology, you know, we look at balancing our platform strategy. I mentioned in North America, we have a Yardi and we push everyone into our Yardi. In Europe, we have gone a slightly different route. We are allowing more freedom of choice to our service providers and they can use their own platform. So we have to balance that you know, tight control versus freedom of it. And do we just use data collection and governance rules instead? And kind of wrapping up, Invesco, we've chosen differently for different regions. And this is part of the compromise that we've had to make to ensure that we operate effectively, if not always to exacting efficiencies. And at the end of the day, for us, it's building strong relationships with the vendors that meet our strategic needs, both regionally and globally, finding those preferred vendors, but also managing strongly the compromises that we have to make in order to perform for our investors. So that's all I have, Chuck.
Chris, that's great. I think what I want to touch on here real quick is the global aspect, because I'm sure we may have people in our audience who are also global tech providers. And I'm curious how the different cultures affected some of the business decision. And is that where you use the term compromise, where you must, comes into play?
Yeah. So, you know, it culturally, you know, I want to be sensitive. You know, different regions and different countries do take different approaches towards, you know, how, as an investment manager, we manage our asset. In some countries, a more hands-off approach, and they really want to let their property managers do their thing. And that is a challenge, where in North America, we're more homogeneous and you have a more normal approach outside of some very select markets. And so, you know, culturally, we have to be very sensitive to maybe a place like Germany, where they're very detail oriented. And can I invest in a product that in a software that's going to meet all of their needs at a global level? Maybe not.
Got it. Well, we'll follow up more when we all get back together towards the end of this. But for now, I'd like to bring in our first tech partner. We've got a video that they have shown. And so let's take a look at Yardi and what's that all about.
Commercial real estate is changing, and Yardi has the right technology to power your strategy. Turn vacancy back into revenue with Yardi Cube, the award-winning solution that helps build a thriving co-working community. Improve energy operations with Yardi Pulse, the energy performance platform that helps you operate your buildings from anywhere. Drive asset performance with Yardi Elevate, the technology suite that connects every aspect of real estate operations. Yardi, energized for tomorrow.
Great. And with that, I want to bring in two of our guests together. That's Scott Tavolacci, National Director of Sales at Yardi Investment Solutions, and Joe DeSalvo, Senior Vice President of RXR Realty. Gentlemen, welcome, and let's hear your story.
Thanks, Chuck. Appreciate the time. Nice to meet everyone. So we've got a couple slides to share here. I think we went over kind of Yardi as a background. But Joe, why don't you maybe give a little background for RXR, and then we'll get to the presentation.
Sure. Joe DeSalvo, Senior Vice President of RXR Realty, which is a vertically integrated owner, operator, developer, and investment manager. My role at RXR is that I'm on the fund and corporate accounting side, as well as very involved in our business information systems team. RXR has over 500 employees. We invest in both commercial and multifamily, as noted here, and invest through private equity real estate funds primarily.
Thanks, Joe. So we want to talk a little bit about our process, and it kind of started a number of years ago, and I'm going to give you a little story. Joe and I actually met at a trade show at lunch, and we were sitting at a table with probably three or four other people discussing, you know, our businesses, what we did, and I started discussing what I did, which I'm the national director of our investment management solutions. So I was talking about our solutions, how we can automate from investor to lease. And we're talking quite a bit about, you know, Most companies have automated property solutions, but investment solutions were really dragging behind. And that most companies have the keeper of the spreadsheet, which is that, I don't know, huge spreadsheet that takes forever to calculate and took a long time to build. And then I said, Joe, well, what do you do? And then Joe kind of made a comment. He goes, I'm the keeper of the spreadsheet. So anyway, so when we started our conversations and started talking about the needs that RXR had, we started in our investment suite. But as we started down that process, RXR is a large organization. So we kind of expanded and say, Joe, you know, to the point where, Joe, you have a lot of different applications. Let's look kind of at the holistic picture. So we kind of want to discuss our process. So maybe, Joe, why don't you discuss, you know, our conversations and the process you went through, and then we could talk about how we worked together and how we created a phased implementation approach.
Sure. And thanks, Scott. And, you know, when we had first looked at it, as Scott noted, our focus was primarily on the investment management suite. That's where I was facing the most challenges because, as everybody knows, we were doing a lot of those P&L allocations, capital call letters. All that was being done in the Microsoft Word and Excel environments, which was not efficient. You know, I had a good team of accountants that was able to do it, but it took a lot of time. And as we started to expand as a company, we needed better tools. So we did our research, and I pitched, you know, investment management to senior executives here, and it made sense. And then we started to look, you know, a little more closely at what else Yardi provided and the rest of the suite of products. And at that point, it made sense that we selected Yardi because there were, you know, a multitude of applications that we felt we could onboard. Our existing GL system at the time was good. It just, there were a lot of patches bolted onto it, and we were trying to create a single stack solution. So initially we had about 14 systems. And Scott, if you want to go to the next slide, we had 14 systems that were leveraged to accommodate essentially limitations of the prior system. So Scott, I don't know if you want to walk through some of
that. So what we tried to do is kind of look at, you know, the major business functions that I think, you know, many of the companies on the phone here have to deal with, you know, raising capital, acquiring assets, operational, fund management, measuring, and then look at the different business functions within there. So what we did to RXR is ask them, well, let's do a map of your different applications. Let's come up with the number of applications. And essentially, as Joe said, they came up with about 14 different applications that were either unintegrated or loosely integrated. So then what we did is cooperatively work together, decide, well, what does it make sense to do? And I think also, how much could you bite off at one point in time? So we did a phased approach. And as we go to the next slide, so Joe, maybe you want to talk to, you know, our different phases in phase one here, what we tried to do and how we tried to distill down the number of systems and create the efficiencies you guys were looking for.
Sure. I'll say this, the implementation that we did was pretty intensive, and it was relatively quick, all things considered. I think from contract signing to going live was about 9 months. Now, that sounds like a long time, but you know, given what we tried to migrate in that first phase, I think it was relatively quick. If phase one, you know, the immediate needs were focused on, which was primarily the investment management solution, and then we onboarded, you know, property accounting and into Yardi Voyager, moved over 3 years of activity, the fixed assets platform, and then commercial cafe, along with the investment management portal. And then, you know, midway through the implementation, we started to focus more towards the company in general had a focus on the multifamily side, which was heating up. So we onboarded Rent Cafe and then Yardi Residential in that initial phase one. So pretty intensive and involving a lot of different disciplines. I think it made the most sense. We started to focus on where we could gain efficiencies initially, and then later focused on in the back end of phase one where we could add, you know, value to the investment community and you know, our tenants. Right? And that was the portal and commercial cafe.
Right. Yeah. So I would say in phase one we were able to probably relieve three or four different systems, and then as with most private equity real estate companies, different deals come up. The ability to add multifamily and some of the other things was created a lot more complexity, which would have added to the number of systems you had, but we were able to create some efficiencies there. So once we, I guess, got that live and just kind of let's talk about maybe phase two, because we in phase two we're kind of building on the platform and creating the single integrated solution. So I think, Joe, we've highlighted three or four additional things here that you guys are working on phase two, and maybe you can talk a little bit about that process and the value it creates.
Right. So phase two is more focused on, you know, the fundraising platform, which is the investment manager suite, which is the CRM we're using to, you know, fundraise our latest fund. I think we're trying to replace, you know, what's, again, an Excel spreadsheet. And it helps from a marketability standpoint, too, because investors, you know, they log into a secure portal, they see your documents, they have a repository. And I think that that's helped us on our the fundraiser, just to manage contacts and relationships in a dedicated system. And then next, we're currently onboarding advanced budgeting and forecasting, which is creating efficiencies for our property management and asset management teams when it comes to the budgeting process. So I think there we are, you know, trying to create value for different areas of the organization. This is mainly an accounting focused implementation in phase one. Now phase two is broadening its horizons to other areas of the business, which again creates value all around. And I think we've tried to make Yardi part of the corporate culture here. And we've learned that through the Elevate suite that Yardi has a product that can do a lot of it. It's just a matter of how we dedicate our time and prioritize that.
Right. So in phase two, we were able to, you know, get you a construction system, obviously relieve another general ledger, create more integration there. And then obviously moving to the advanced budgeting and forecasting and then upgrading your portal and with the CRM. So let's talk about the next step. And I know we've talked about this. There's a couple other steps that you guys are looking to create some efficiencies. So Joe, why don't you talk about maybe phase three, which, you know, these are just in discussions, but, you know, do create some additional efficiencies for you.
Right. So I think a document management system like SharePoint is something that we're focusing on next. You know, right now it's a little archaic, but I think that'll benefit the entire organization as a whole. And then procure to pay being the next, you know, phase after that. And I see Chuck. So I think that means
No, let's go to your values here, because these are important.
Yeah. So maybe you talk to the values that you've gotten from here.
One of the things that I think is really important is, you know, thinking about, you know, shortly after we went onto Yardi IM, we did a retail raise, bringing in, you know, a couple hundred investors into our latest fund. And prior to that, our fund investor base had been limited, you know, big pension funds and the like. So now we're focused on retail investors and thinking through what that capital call process would be like. I don't think we could have done 1,200 capital call letters or 1,200 NAV statements without the help of Yardi. So an immediate need of measurable value was creating, you know, documents within Yardi that can be blasted out to the entire community as we, you know, as we create them. So that was a big efficiency, thinking about the quarter close process and just day-to-day time savings and things, you know, the very manual processes that we do, the consolidation process in Investment Manager and in Yardi Voyager has really streamlined our reporting timeframes. And then also the last thing I'll add is that marketability. I think investors are asking these types of questions now, you know, regarding your controls and capability of your people and your systems. And when you use a name like Yardi, I think it means a lot, you know, that you have a serious back office. And that's what we've tried to do is create that internally, and Yardi's helped do that.
I think that sounds good, Joe. I would suspect then you probably could identify with some of the themes that I introduced in my opening statement. So that sounds good. We'll circle back on those whenever we finish up at the end. But for now, let's bring in our next tech partner. We want to see this video introduction of Cohen Resnick. Very good. That sounds great. Let me introduce Mike Ivey. He's a consultant with Cohen Resnick, focused on investment management implementations. Mike, welcome. Appreciate you being here today.
Thank you, Chuck. Good morning. Good afternoon to everyone. So I'm a director with the investment management group practice at Cohn Reznick. So I wanted to talk a little bit today about the human element and how it relates to the process we're striving to achieve, and also as it relates to the process to get there. So on all these IAM implementations, there's a lot of focus on the technology and the data aspect, and rightfully so. But if you're disproportionately focusing on those two things at the expense of the process and the people elements, your project is not likely to realize its full potential. So, for example, if I just take my current existing process and shoehorn that into a new software, that's a missed opportunity. And if we're, as a project team, not engaging the people and building that trust, that we're leading them down the yellow brick road and not down a dead end alleyway, not everyone's going to be on board with where we're going, and that's also going to lead to challenges as you move through the project. So one of the ways we ensure that we're doing that is viewing automation not as something that's intrinsically good or something that's an end in itself, but viewing it more in terms of augmentation. It's augmenting a human decision-making process. So augmentation is not a dirty word in this case. It's really what we're striving for. If you look at these different decision models here, like all the way over onto the left where it's the 100% human-led, this is the person who's got a typewriter on their desk and a slide rule. Not a recipe for success there. And then all the way over to the right, the other extreme where it's 100% machine-led, this is kind of venturing into, the Matrix, Terminator 2 territory. It's scary. We don't want to go there. Really, the sweet spot is in the middle, this machine-led, human-supported model, where you're automating to the greatest extent possible in the service of these human-led decision-making processes. So, one good example to illustrate that, I think, is if you think about self-driving cars. I mean, that's a technology that's evolving rapidly, but it still has some issues and some challenges around it. And one of the big challenges there is that all the other drivers on the road are humans. And then you have pedestrians, people on bicycles, armadillos in the road. And the frustrating thing with people sometimes is they have a tendency to do irrational things, make irrational decisions. And that's the challenge there, and maybe armadillos as well. But eventually, maybe all these cars will be using the self-driving technology, and that mitigates that risk somewhat. But pivoting back to an IAM perspective, your investors, the tenants in your buildings, your competitors, those will continue to be led by human decision makers. So you always have that irrational aspect that you have to account for. If you're not asking the question that Jeff is kind of begging us to ask here of ourselves, you might be unnecessarily automating things. And, worst case scenario might be, the dinosaurs are eating your accountants, but more likely, the outcome is just not going to be to maximum benefit that it could potentially have. So transitioning from a gold bloom to a flower, so I guess it's happy little accident, as Bob Ross would say, you might be wondering why we're looking at a flower right now. So let me explain that a little bit. So on all these IAM implementation projects, you typically hear some variation of one of these phrases. Our structure is the most complex, or we have stuff that you're not going to be able to automate. We're different from everyone else. We do things differently from everyone else. Now, as you do more of these, there is definitely a kernel of truth in that, and that's what I find so compelling about this work, is as you work on more of these IAM projects, everyone does tend to have something unique that you encounter, and that keeps it fresh. But as you do more and more of these, patterns start to emerge. If I had done this in years prior, I might have used a snowflake analogy here, but that's taken on different connotations lately, so we'll stick to flowers. But as those patterns start to emerge, you start to develop patterns that you can apply to address those challenges across these different unique but related scenarios that you might encounter. And then, you know, you think of the IAM implementations, it's more like chess than checkers. And the pieces that you have, regardless of what software you're using, the pieces that you have, the tools at your disposal, are similar. And the rules that govern what they can and cannot do are also similar. But the human element comes into play with, you know, how you engage those pieces and what one do you even choose to deploy. So I might not get to this many implementations in my career. It might take a few generations, but the point is the more exposure to you get to it, the broader your perspective. And using myself as an example, you know, 20 something years ago, I moved from Nebraska to LA to go to film school. So who or what would have predicted that I'm doing this today? And it was probably a series of irrational decisions on my part that led me to this, but I love where I'm at right now, and I love what I'm doing right now, and, you know, film school is kind of overrated anyway.
As long as you don't wear your Cornhusker t-shirt to
I'm the black sheep of the family. I went to Missouri.
Nice going. Hey, tell me a little bit more about the human element part of these processes.
Yeah. So one of the things, this was an interesting scenario that came up when we were implementing for a fund manager, and they had multiple funds. There was one separate account that had a different book, and we asked them about it, and they said, well, it's this client's very particular about some of the reporting that they get. We keep that separate book so we can provide the reporting that they want to have. And we asked, is there any way that we can no longer keep that in the new configuration that will keep things simpler? I don't think they're going to budge on that, but we pushed them to go ahead and ask the question. You know, could we automate it? Sure. And if they came back with the answer, yes, they won't budge, we absolutely need it, we could have done that. But we still pushed to ask the question. And couple hours later, the controller comes back into the conference room and says, but we don't need that book. I asked him about it. I said, you know, we have to do some extra steps to provide it. Is this really necessary? And the person he was talking to said, well, we thought this was a limitation on your side. We were working around it on our side, you know, and it was just a communication issue where they weren't, weren't touching base on it. It was a completely unnecessary piece of thing. So that's where it can come into play, where it's, you know, automation that doesn't not really adding any value.
Yeah, I think sometimes too they get on that that's the way we've always done it bandwagon.
And, exactly.
Problem. So, well, thank you, Mike, for that. We're going to watch a quick video from MRI at this point. So stay tuned.
We believe in the power of a well-connected community. That's why we build software that transforms how people live, work, and play. It's the reason we're creating new ways to attract great residents and deliver digital experiences that make life easier for you and your tenants. We believe that businesses should have less busy work and that the right data should be easily accessible so every lease works for you. We design software that's truly open and flexible, giving you more ways to adapt, more ways to grow, and more ways to shape your future. We strive to create ways for communities to live better, work smarter, and play a whole lot more. Because we believe people thrive in well-connected communities.
Well, that's a fun video. Thanks for that one. Let me introduce Eric Hogan. He's the VP of Financial and Investment Solutions with MRI Software. Eric, welcome.
Thanks, Chuck. Thanks for having me. My name is Eric Hogan. As you said, I'm responsible for really all of our accounting and investment management related solutions at MRI. What I like to call the money suite. really anything that's involved in the accounting for tracking, reporting on the funds going in and out of the portfolio from investors, managing cash flows and valuations, and ultimately reporting on performance. So I love that Mike was talking about the human element, because it's really a big part of how we think about things, and it's certainly been, trying to get the slide to work here. There we go. It's certainly been at the forefront of our minds as a technology provider with respect to, you know, what's happened in 2020, because even prior to the pandemic, we started to focus our efforts on not just experiences for back office and front office individuals within these real estate investment companies, but also the experiences of every other human being that's interacting with those assets. Tenants, residents, vendors, investors, and so on. And so the human element is such a significant component of, I think, any strategic plan for a real estate investor. And when we look at 2020, a really good example of how, you know, our clients are, and we internally are thinking about things, is to look at core assets. What happened to core assets was quite interesting during 2020, because you see the valuation of offices, retail malls, apartments, hotels drop, whilst the valuation of buildings like storage facilities and data warehouses, data centers, and warehouses, those valuations were increasing. But then from a transaction volume perspective, we see not a lot of transaction volume in these distressed sort of office and retail assets, but certainly high transaction volume in with respect to apartment buildings and hotels, and certainly in the industrial sector as well. And so when we look at that, we're thinking, well, what's really driving this? And it ultimately comes down to the human factor. Those assets that were dependent on high footfall, high sort of human interaction, like offices and apartment buildings, their valuations were impacted, but those only certain asset classes were considered by investors as ones that would bounce back in a post-COVID world, specifically apartments and hotels. And so there's a strategic sort of variable that needs to be considered there, right? Investors are investing right now in assets that they think will bounce back. And in order to do that, they have to consume a lot of data points. I think in the Cohn-Resnick video, it mentioned the fact that the data points we're considering over time have changed. And certainly as human beings, both from a back office and front office perspective, and you know, how tenants and residents are concerned, the experiences need to go up a notch in a post-COVID world. So we're not just considering, you know, environmental considerations. Certainly, we now focus on health, sustainability, and the importance of things like art and culture and attractions in the community. So we're investing not just in a building anymore, but investing in the surrounding community and amenities that will drive people out of their homes, no longer shopping at home, no longer working from home, but actually drive them out of their homes because they will experience something that they can't experience at home. So the tech element here is really, how do we ensure that the technology, the systems that we're using, eliminate inefficiencies, make that data, that ever-growing data set of variables and factors, how do we normalize that data? How do we make it consumable? How do we act upon it quickly? And how do we leverage technology to automate a lot of the sort of the repetitive and logical elements of getting that data ready and then acting on that data? And the human element is that thing that data technology is never going to truly replace. Human beings will always be needed to analyze those aspects of the real estate life cycle and the market that were unpredictable and or irregular. Like, no one could have predicted what was going to happen to core assets because the pandemic was unprecedented. So we don't talk about technology in terms of solving all these problems. We talk about it as something that can help with a lot of the logical, repetitive elements of the investment management sort of process. And human beings can just get stuck into actually doing the analysis. So with that said, our smart, nimble experiences are really the most important things. Smart, getting the data, making it normalized, making it consumable, and then being able to make confident decisions quickly.
How do you think, Eric, the investor expectations have changed, thinking about the human element over the last 15 months, given what everybody, how everybody has shifted their business?
We saw in the post-2008 world that investors suddenly became much more interested in low-level data points. Right? Sending out a quarterly report with a time-weighted return and some basic attributes about those assets was no longer sufficient. They wanted to know about the types of tenants in those buildings, the types of clauses within the leases. And now we see a lot more consideration of those new data points: sustainability, environment, health and safety, the extent to which that building is best served by the surrounding community. These are things that, again, the investors want low-level detail, but that data set, the scope of that data has expanded.
Got it. I think we're going to explore a lot more on data governance and those efforts and barriers to entry when we all get back together. So thanks again for that. Let's move on to our next tech sponsor. I want to introduce Kevin Stoffman. He's the Chief Operating Officer of Navigator CRE and oversees their global enterprise engagement. Kevin, welcome.
Chuck, I appreciate it.
Yeah, good job. Go for it.
I always like skipping the video too. I want to talk about something that most of the panelists, some of our clients have already discussed, and that's the value of actually integrating all of these tools together. Navigator is obviously a proud partner of a lot of the other technology partners in this call, including some that the clients are using, like Juniper Square, Yardi, MRI, et cetera. If you can't measure the return on investment of a specific technology investment, there's a better way. I think this next statement is going to be a little controversial, so sorry, Joe. If it's taking 9 months to introduce to implement a piece of software, there is a better way, right? And if you're waiting even hours for information that you're going to need at an executive level to make decisions, there's a better way. And that better way is aligning all of your systems together, not just one tool with another, but every tool together to get access to information, regardless of whether you have technical expertise in one particular tool or in one particular geographic region or in one particular corporate department. You should have access across your company as long as the executives bless that access in order to collaborate and make decisions faster. And Invesco is a great example of this. They've spent a lot of time and resources getting all of their data aligned together so that they can integrate systems together to accelerate decision making. You'll notice, Tyson spent a lot of time on the investor relations piece, integrating systems together so that raising capital becomes more self-service, right? And then Joe at RXR took a lot of their accounting operations and put them into a single stack, integrated together, so that the accounting team can produce reports faster. So only when you align the data and the underlying systems that hold the data and the teams that use those systems do you actually get to something that's going to be better than your competitors. And because this is all investment management people on the call, I just wanted to give three quick examples that are direct probably to your business. The first example is producing financial reporting. There shouldn't be multiple people combining a bunch of different data sets that are disparate in order to get to a single report. whether that's for the CFO, that's for the street, that's for private separately managed accounts, that access should now be available dynamically on demand. When an investor logs in to see their own investments, it should be self-service, right? They should see their own investments siloed in their specific data, and any question can be answered about those assets. How have they performed compared to the benchmark? What's the underlying tenant mix if that information is allowed to be seen? What capital projects are going on in that building? What comps are around those buildings and how are these performing better? They should have access to that information because you as clients already have that data. It's just about integrating it and visualizing it in such a way that it's valuable. And this becomes most important to executives. Executives shouldn't have to schedule a single meeting to talk about a single deal they're bidding on and then have a cascade of meetings to prepare for that meeting. You should be able to accomplish more within each discussion and more even without meetings themselves. And that's what full systems integration does. It brings all of the information together and aligns functionality so that you get actual use case value in the business. There's obviously multiple stations to do this. Your company might be in different stages of this journey. The first thing you have to do, right, is align all of your data. Some of our great clients, Bell, Invesco, RXR on this call have talked about how they've aligned their data as step one, right? So they can act on it. But then you got to go a step further, right? Then you have to integrate all the system's functionality together. So it's not just data sharing, it's workflow sharing. So that once the business gets a hold of this, they can make decisions faster. And lastly, how you use a system should not just be trained on what table to use or what button to click. You need training relevant to your business. How do I answer an investor's question? How do I renegotiate a lease? How do I reach out to a tenant that owes me money and have an effective negotiation with them? Training in your technology should enable you to do all of those things. And in order to get to step five, you really need executive sponsorship, a culture of data sharing, a way that people can access information without having to learn a bunch of different tools. And like Chris said, right, adequate personnel that has localized knowledge so that it's not just about the tech you're using, it's about the value that's being provided. I know I've got a lot of time left, Chuck, but I really just wanted to get through these slides quickly and say that really this is just all about integrating data, systems, and teams together so that the decisions you're making, material decisions you're making in your business, what portfolios to buy, who to hire and fire, those decisions can be made quicker and without sacrificing.
Can you go back one slide to those different phases? I wanted to ask you something specific. It would seem like to me, and I would, if we were to take a particular poll, I would think a lot of the companies would identify with organized chaos. No matter where they are. I mean, even if they're in some sort of a journey, do you typically see a client in a data alignment or systems integration?
I would say most folks are in phase two, at least the ones that have done great things by partnering with firms like Code Resonant, one of my former homes. Having a consulting partner help you decide what sets of data are needed to be aligned to deliver value, I think is an important piece of the puzzle. And internally, a lot of companies do steering committees to figure that kind of stuff out. A lot of companies also go down the path of trying to build a data warehouse, thinking that that's the answer, just build the data warehouse, align the data, we're good to go, put some biz on top. No, it really getting to step three is the important step that we see with most of our clients.
All right, so we're going to follow up on that one too, because I think you're right. A lot of people do think data warehouse, data lakes, that's the key holy grail to systems integration. And I think we're hearing from two of our technology partners here today that may not be the case. So I definitely want to follow up on more of that. So thank you for sharing this piece. And I've got one more question we'll bring on at the end. So at this point, let me bring in a video for DealPath and give you an introduction of what they're doing.
Commercial real estate investment is complex and difficult to manage. DealPath makes it easy to focus on what matters. You can easily share documents with internal and external partners with customizable access settings so people only see what's appropriate. DealPath organizes all your deal information, files, and communications in one place.
DealPath's powerful reporting tools allow you to quickly analyze deals across your pipeline so you can mitigate risks and execute flawlessly. DealPath, this is Smart Deal Management.
All right, very good. Let me introduce to you Joe Moskowitz. He's the Director of Business Development and Strategic Solutions at DealPath. Joe.
Hey, thanks, Chuck. And thank you, Nancy, and the RealCom team for having me today. And those that are on the webinar, thanks for joining. So I'm at DealPath. I work on business development and strategic solutions. Today, I'm going to take you through a brief deck and talk about three ways that IT teams can remove inefficiencies across the pipeline. And I say IT teams, but really I'm referring to business technology teams, the actual business users themselves, and anyone who is a stakeholder in technology and deal management and software implementations across the organization. So first thing, it really starts with a smart, goal-oriented implementation that's tailored to your process. You're most likely not the first deployment and can therefore benefit from similar use cases and existing users of the platform. Existing users who are more than likely your industry peers and competitors for investment opportunities. Now, I know that all CRE investment organizations are different, but to an extent, they're also similar in a lot of ways. The point is, leverage the technology organization, leverage what they've already done successfully, and know that you're not actually starting at point zero. What you want to do is avoid generic and canned tools that force your processes to adapt instead of streamlining your existing processes. So you really have to find that sweet spot between industry standards and what's been done successfully and what works in the tech organization, but also your core processes and what's been working for you as an organization. That sweet spot right in the middle, that's where you're going to be truly successful with technology implementations. It'll also, with those things, allow you to go live with the software with a very minimal amount of change management. Obviously, change management is, a scary concept, and it's on, top of mind for a lot of us when we're thinking about software implementations. But keeping these concepts in mind, there really is a way for you to minimize that change management. So in thinking about tech-driven process automation, you really look for a platform that applies smart configuration across your team, across your organization, and across your pipeline. If X, then what happens? Then who needs to get involved? If Y, then who needs to approve this? Then what happens? What's the sequence of events that occurs after, X, Y, or Z? And there's a lot of areas where this could be commonly applied across the organization: access, user access and user management, data completeness and data governance. So what sort of things across all of my workflows need to happen every single time, regardless of what the scenario is? After I identify those things, how can the software that I'm implementing understand that and work with me each time to ensure that those things are getting done, that those things are getting complete? Approval workflows, and then dashboards and reporting. We're all generating reports for key stakeholders. We're all generating reports at regular cadences for investment committees and third-party investors. How can we leverage the technology to automate the generation of these reports, but also automate the delivering of these reports systematically? And having these auto configurations will allow you and your team to identify and address where there's some potential human bottlenecks and then create efficiencies that way as well. And the last point here is to find a platform that's forward-looking and that has good market share. Because with good market share, the tech platform sort of organically evolves into the best version of itself. So think iPhone jailbreaking, for example. So Apple, iPhone jailbreaking when engineering and tech folks sort of manipulate the iPhone to make it do what they want it to do, right? Apple utilizes these jailbroken custom iPhones to get a better understanding of what the end users actually want out of these iPhones, and then bring that back to their product roadmap and sort of work it into the product development. And that's what you're going to find with a lot of these technology platforms that have a good customer base. It's going to be a direct reflection of what the market at large is asking for out of an investment management technology software. And then the third thing, and this is going to go a lot into Kevin's previous presentation, is to really capitalize on integrations to centralize the information and to centralize these insights. You really want to leverage the API framework that these technology platforms have to bring it into your existing tech ecosystem. I mean, most technology platforms are in constant communication with one another, whether it be, you know, building out substantial interfaces with each other or just scoping out ways to exchange data one-off. I know that, you know, myself, I'm always speaking to Navigator, I'm speaking to MRI and Yardi, I'm speaking to consulting firms like Cohen Resnick and Real Foundations to figure out how we can make these integrations more robust. And I implore you as an end user to sort of think about it in the same way, right? What is standard and what's not standard? Ask these questions to the tech vendor, but also know that they're not really limitations, right? If something is not standard, maybe not built out, there's not a pre-existing integration between, you know, the software you're talking to and one that you have in your ecosystem, that doesn't mean that there can't be. Most of these tech platforms have a robust API framework that can be connected to other platforms with a little bit of work on the tech side, regardless of whether it's standard or whether it's not. And the last thing that I'll just briefly touch upon is a case study with Oxford. The challenge for them was to really centralize and improve access to real-time and historical data while creating these efficiencies across their workflow. And the solution was recognizing that software development for Oxford was not their core competency. You know, industry-leading investments and investment management, that was their core competency. So having, you know, implementing DealPath to sort of handle the software development piece of what their core competency is together made them an overall holistic, successful solution for Oxford. Chuck?
And 3 days of work into 3 minutes. You're standing by that?
I am. Yes. And I implore you all to do the same.
Oh, okay. No, that's good. I noticed identifying and removing bottlenecks on your last slide. How do you think companies can get better doing that?
Well, there's certainly a lot of ways, and you could even leverage the technology to do so. So for example, in DealPath, we have a very robust task management, task workflow piece of the software where you can see who's working on what and get insight into, you know, where things may be taking longer, create some pattern recognition on how long certain aspects of the deal management workflow should be taking, and then sort of drill down into the reasons why things are getting caught up in a certain deal phase, and then get better at it. Take your human element of your deal workflow and improve upon it.
Now you mentioned, we got a few more seconds here, so I want to hit on a couple of points that you said because I don't want to lose it. You mentioned tech-driven projects versus business-driven projects. Wouldn't you get pushback from that from most companies?
Well, I think that it's a combination of the two, right? I think that a lot of times organizations are finding a significant dichotomy between the tech team and the business team. The sweet spot is to find, or organize a committee, regular touch points between the tech and the business sides of the organization to get a true understanding of what's needed, and then look for software that can solve for, you know, the conversations that you're having together.
Okay. All right. Great. I'm going to ask you one more question while Nancy brings the rest of our panel in, because we'll have more questions for everybody else. But you mentioned something. I want to ask you, why do you say automation in commercial real estate is a slippery slope? And everyone else can bring their cameras on while you're answering, so we can all smile at you.
Well, I think that a lot of these investment committees get a little nervous when it comes to automation because they want to keep all of the decisions and control within the human element side of things and not really let that all go. So there is a potential for it to be a slippery slope, but the goal is to find that sweet spot between leveraging standardization, templatization, and industry best practices that a software company like DealPath knows and implements, but then also having your processes fit into that software. So you're still doing things the way that you have been and that's been working for you, and you're still maintaining control over the decisions you're making. You're just making them in a smarter way.
Okay, Tyson, I want you to react to that. There's automation being a slippery slope and tech-driven versus business-driven.
Sure. So we have benefited a lot, really, from the automation piece, and the people side is important as well. But what we found is that it's really been helpful. There's not been a downside necessarily from the automation side on our end.
Okay, Chris, what do you think? Okay, you gotta get off mute. Right.
Yeah.
You can see the tech is already throwing you off.
That's right. From our from an Invesco perspective, we have taken advantage of a lot of automation specifically. It's really around managing the processes up front, make sure they're streamlined and clear before we can do that.
Okay. Joe, I wanted to, you introduced a complex set of applications when you talked about these 14 applications that you were working together. How did the idea of data governance, data cleanup, data integration, how did that influence the phases that you had?
Yeah, I think as we started to look at systems, right, overall, it's, you know, there were different owners of different systems, right? So I think having one source of the truth was really important for us, particularly when it comes to investors, right? I think it's a really bad answer if there's a manual error in an Excel spreadsheet and, you know, you have to correct it quarter over quarter, or it pulls in from a different interface. So for us, I think data governance is still something we're working on internally, but it's really important that we have one source of the truth. That's something Scott, you know, Scott, when he does a really good job pitching these things, right? Because I think it's important that you can show the investor, and even some of the new Yardi products, not to overpitch Yardi, but they allow the investor to kind of look into your Yardi. Should you turn that permission on? That's a scary thought, but it does create a little sense of urgency, you know, on our team to make sure that it's all clean. So to answer your question, I think it's was probably the most paramount, the paramount point in deciding what to implement.
See, and that's the sense that I get from businesses, is that they really want to understand their data. And if they've got a bad starting point, if it's chaos, kind of like what right. Kevin had shown early on, it makes it a little bit more difficult. But Kevin, you showed there was a good way to overcome that. And I think, Eric, you talked about that too during our previous call, of how structured systems, ERP systems, can be married to non-structured systems, including Excel, including other data sources, to provide some level of structure so that you're not caught in a data governance project for 2 years before you
can start. Your device is disconnect.
I think it goes beyond just structuring the data in the right way. It comes to the system or the business defining what a specific term means in the system, right? How Yardi or MRI or Juniper Square or DealPath define turn time, lease trade out, economic occupancy may differ. And so exposing those definitions directly inside a dashboard so you can see what does the business refer to when they think of this, and standardizing that definition across the business is helpful. It becomes a little more complex for someone like Chris and Invesco, right? Because you might have localized accounting laws that define certain things in certain ways. So then you need to divide up the data in the regions and then expose those definitions so that when you consolidate information and report it out to investors, everybody understands exactly what they're looking at, whether it's consolidated or whether it's siloed.
Okay, all right, Eric, you want to follow up on that?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think what's changed is in the past, when it came to the data problem, people gravitated towards either standardizing data formats or getting everything into sort of a single database, because then it kind of forces you to normalize into that sort of structure or schema. But the reality is that technology today allows you to avoid that if it makes sense for your business. If you can define, to Kevin's point, a normalized library of terms and concepts that make sense to your business, the technology that's available today can then take care of the mapping and normalization and aggregation and publishing of all that data across multiple systems in a way that makes sense to you, right? Whether it's through some managed service that, you know, that sort of takes advantage of RPA and machine learning to kind of handle that mapping, or some other mechanism. But the technology is there. So standardization, no longer as critical as it once was.
Scott, and maybe you want to integrate this with Joe. I mean, that moving a lot more towards the Yardi database, moving from other third-party systems and consolidating with Yardi modules, things in that side of Elevate, that had to have been a clear benefit, I think, for RXR. It had to be top of mind. So was that, how much did that factor in for the Yardi solution versus looking at a data warehouse, for example?
I think from our perspective, I think it factored a lot, because as much as we could get into one environment and satisfy their needs, and just having one vendor or one solution, I think creates efficiencies. But with that being said, there are times and in different areas where, you know, multiple systems are needed and integrations are needed within the environment. But, you know, Joe, I guess, you know, maybe you want to add to that.
Yeah, no, well, one thing I'll say is that our technology committee has been smart to ask the question, does Yardi offer something like this, right? And I think we evaluated piece by piece, and not just, Yardi is not necessarily the default. We're looking at where the best technology is for the end user, right? And you're seeing that we have a roadmap to onboard a few more Yardi products. But that being said, you know, sometimes you have to look at what the needs are, you know, and you know, there are times where we've said no because, hey, this system works great now, and it's more of a hassle for us to take 500 users of our payable system and migrate them over than it is to, you know, gain the efficiency that Yardi is. So sometimes you have to deal with, you know, prioritizing the, you know, weigh the pros and cons of it. And the implementations are hard, they take time, and they weigh on, you know, the whole change management process here. I could do a whole webinar on that, coaching people through it, but that there's some sensitivities to it. I think we have to be smart about how we pitch the efficiencies to the team and prioritizing when they start and who's involved.
I think you bring up a great point, the idea of change management, but certainly the scope of the project can be a major influence. And I'm going to go to Mike here, and maybe we'll follow up with Chris, because this idea of, when you've got a global company, North America, Europe, Asia Pacific, are you treating it like three different projects, or do you really try to move towards commonality, or just accept the fact that it's different? How do you start? Let's start with Mike. Get off of mute, Mike.
Sorry. Yeah, definitely try to move towards commonality as much as possible. I mean, and one of the things that we try to be cognizant of here is, you know, I talked a little bit more in a little bit in my presentation about the macro, more organizational impact of this human element, but there's more of a micro impact of these individuals on the team, right? And a lot of times they might really walk into these initial meetings hating their job or viewing it as drudgery because of their current tools and inefficient processes or whatever the case may be. And you know, we all love what we do, but we, you know, they're going to walk in with some of these preconceived notions, and we have to kind of dispel that. And I like to do that more on a collective basis, whether it's a global project or something, you know, something that's even smaller scale, building that unity on the team and unity of purpose.
Got it. Now, Chris, when you described yours, you specifically started in North America and then went to Europe and now still going to Asia Pacific. Do you regret that, or would it have been better to bring everybody together and, you know, sort of try to build the team as a cohesive global unit?
No, I would say our technology platform has evolved with the business. You know, our business started in North America and grew into Europe and then grew in Asia. So you see this evolution that, you know, there are more mature platforms and processes and technology already in existence. So when we approach everything, We want to leverage as much as we've already built or bought as possible as we expand into new, not just new regions, but new asset classes or strategies. There's an immense amount of pressure from a global investor. I mean, it's a $1.4 trillion fiduciary, of which real estate is really a small piece. So even though real estate does act like three different companies regionally, we're always looking for ways to, you know, be more lean and consolidate technology. So now that we have a more mature business, that platform has to follow suit.
Got it. Joe, you're nodding. What do you think?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, I mean, Chris, did you find yourself, as you were thinking about, you know, global expansion from an investment standpoint, turning back to your technology ecosystem and saying, hey, you know, we're not just using you as a client, but we're more like partners. How, you know, here's what we have planned in terms of going to new markets and investments in new markets. How can you help support what we have planned, and how can we sort of grow together? I mean, from a deal path standpoint, we always find ourselves having these conversations with our clients, trying to figure out what new investment strategies they have coming down the pipe and what new markets they're getting into, because it directly affects, you know, how we approach our product roadmap. So I'm wondering if you find yourself having similar.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'll pick on Yardi as an example, Scott. You know, we work very exclusively with Yardi around our core financials and performance in the IM in North America. And when we launched a debt strategy 4 years ago in North America, we have loan servicers out there, but we wanted to build out the loan servicing module to accommodate our needs. And Yardi bent over backwards to meet our needs. And now we're launching a product in Europe and we're doing the same thing. So leveraging those strong relationships, managing those vendor partnerships is just so incredibly valuable to us. And we hope that Yardi sees it the same way, as, you know, as we're, you know, trending towards this or pushing the boundaries for them, they can then take it to other vendors. I'm sorry, other customers as well.
Got it. Kevin, you wanted to add?
Well, I was just going to say, it kind of backs up to Mike's point. You know, some people hate their jobs, and so they appreciate the value of technology to change them. But on the flip side of that, a lot of people like what they do, and they're comfortable with their process. And as someone with a lot of CIOs, both information and innovation as friends, I realized how much of a nightmare it can be to rip and replace a bunch of tech on the promise that it's going to improve the business. And oftentimes that's not the answer, right? The answer is actually just integrating the technology you're already using in better ways, so that people don't have to train on new systems. They don't have to learn a bunch of new skill sets. They can concentrate on their actual day-to-day business tasks. And then, you know, information is just there at the ready. And I think most of the people on this call as clients, right, they've gone down that journey of realizing what needs to be ripped and replaced, but what can just be integrated and improved. And that to me is, it's less time, it's less money, it's much more time to value.
Got it. Mike, I want to focus in on a little bit of something you said, and then we'll get a few reactions. The idea of machine controlled, that's on the far end of the spectrum. Is it realistic to think investment managers are moving down that to analyze, decide, act cycle in more machine controlled RPA, AI, machine learning, that sort of thing?
There's always going to be that line in the sand where there's a human component of it that's being retained and not being compromised. I don't think you're ever going 100% all the way there on any of these things.
Got it. Eric, real quick, your thought. AI.
Yeah, I agree. There's always going to be that secret sauce that's only in the brains of a human being. Otherwise, we get to a situation where every single computer around the globe is telling you to buy the same building, right? Everyone's going to have their own strategy. There are going to be things like pandemics. God forbid, another one hits that a machine's never really going to be able to predict, but a machine can predict the more kind of repeated investment life cycle as you go through the stages of, from growth to recession and sort of what happens to interest rates and inflation and transaction volumes through that cycle. A building can do that, but a human being needs to decide how to then maneuver through that to achieve their specific goals.
Got it. Thank you guys so much. Nancy, I'm turning it back to you. And if you saw, we had almost 50% of our audience is tuned in because they have a secret admirer on the panel. We're not going to say who that might be, but I'm just throwing my vote to Nancy. So.
Thanks, Chuck.
Oh, wow, great session, everyone. Thank you, Chuck, for moderating, and thanks to all our panelists for participating. We appreciate your willingness to share your inside experience and recommendations with our audience today. Before we sign off, I'd like to take just 1 minute to mention a few events we have coming up over the next week. First, tune in tomorrow for our weekly news show, RealCom Live. This week, our conversation will be focused on training our next generation of OT cyber experts. And then also be sure to tune in next Thursday for the third part, the final part of our in-building wireless series, which will focus on 5G. You can register on our website, or I've just posted a link in the chat window that you can use as well. Lastly, we are excited to announce that RealCom IBCon 2021 will be held in November in Scottsdale, Arizona. Mark your calendars and check our website in the next couple of weeks for complete details. That's it for today. Thanks again for joining us. Enjoy your day.
Bye.
Bye.